Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, dear friends and podcast listeners. I'm Ed Mallion, and this is the Indie Football Podcast. Here we are back on Mondays after a special edition on Friday in which we broke down transfer deadline day and the summer's action off the field. Now we have months ahead of hopefully only discussing what happens on it. And to help me do that today, I have some of Indie Sports' finest. So without further ado, allow me to introduce our chief football writer. He is half Spanish, half Irish, but wholly committed to covering England this week. It's Miguel Delaney.
All right.
A reminder, you're not listening at 1.5 times speed. That is just how fast Miguel speaks. And also here, with three lions on his shirt, two surnames and one dream to be the best podcaster he can be, it's Jack Pitbrook, everyone.
Afternoon.
And firstly, making his podcast debut, the Indie Football Engine Room, it's Ben Burrows. Ben, say hello.
Hello.
He's delighted to be here. And also hello to producer Tom Goulding. He's filling in for Matt this week. He doesn't have a microphone, so you can't see him saying hello. Right, international break, guys. Usually a great time to take some holiday if you work in sports journalism because it feels like the death of anything fun or interesting. But I think this international break has thrown up more issues than usual. So we do, thanks to Gareth Southgate, actually have some interesting topics to delve into. One of those, Miguel, you wrote about on Saturday, and you can read that by heading to independent.co.uk/sport, as ever. That piece was about the England captaincy. So first, start us off by telling us what Gareth Southgate actually said.
Well, yeah, basically he is continuing this policy of rotating the captaincy on a game-by-game basis. He probably has about three or four main candidates, but his whole idea is to try and develop leadership in the team so more and more players show the skills, I suppose, required in that regard. But it's obviously become a slightly, not controversial topic, but it's become a topic of debate because Southgate was directly asked on Thursday whether he would pick a full-time captain for the tournament. And he said he still hasn't made up his mind, which would be a massive break from historical tradition. But I think more interestingly, it was one of his comments. I mean, this discussion went on about like 5 to 7 minutes of a 20-minute press conference. But then he just goes, yeah, it's on my list of priorities, not high. which I suppose is quite a contrast to maybe how it's covered. And I think Southgate is absolutely right because, I mean, we know so many of the issues with England over the past two decades and all of that. But I think one of the issues almost around the England team, there's always kind of strange obsessions that take up so much mental space and mental energy rather than kind of things maybe we should actually be talking about. And I think Southgate is trying to change that. And I think this captaincy issue is one of them.
I just want to say the captaincy is a sort of all this talk about the captaincy, at least, is a distraction from what they should be doing, which is concentrating on trying to get beyond the last 16.
Yeah, also, I mean, like the captaincy has been such a massive issue for the past two decades, and what's it actually meant in the end?
The headline of your piece says that Gareth Southgate's philosophy on captaincy is the kind of evolutionary approach England are crying out for. So you think that Southgate is actually taking the team on by diminishing these non-issues.
I think there are other, as I think an important caveat, I think there are other issues with Southgate's management. You still have some doubts about him and the job. And I think what is more concerning than anything is that the quality of England's attacking play has actually gradually declined as he's been in the job. And I think they were very poor on Friday. But in saying that, I think everything else he's doing around the team is actually correct. And I quite like him, I have to say.
Jack, someone once told me that England captain is just something that agents use in contract negotiations as a title. How do you feel about the issue itself?
Yeah, I think Southgate's absolutely right. I think that the obsession with the England captaincy has been damaging over the last 20 years, probably for longer than that, because it's basically part of a culture where we try and understand the England team and all sorts of team sports as if they're functions of individual will. Basically, if you have a captain, then and you obsess about the who is the captain, then it just like you kind of forget, or it's easy, it's you are distracted from like trying to think about the mechanics of team sport or the dynamics of how you want the team to play. And that has very much been the case, I think, with England for a long time. And that idea, you'd like to think that the less we think about who wears the armband, the more we might think about why it takes 65 minutes to score a goal against Malta, mm-hmm. or questions like that. And so in that sense, I think this is one of a number of areas where Southgate is in exactly the right place and has got kind of knows what is and isn't worth talking about.
Also, there might be something that comes from his background, which is he's been working with all the youth teams. Mm. So obviously, before this, he was under 21 manager. And because they see players coming through, and you could have an under 21 captain who's suddenly the next international break, he's not with your squad, he's with someone else. And perhaps he's seen there that there is not actually that much of an importance to the team. Ben, do you feel like there is probably an excessive obsession with this? By is it the fans or is it the media? Or
I think so. I think if you look at particularly other sports in England, say cricket, where the captain is particularly important, rugby is similar.
He's a de facto coach on the field, and cricket makes all the decisions.
Whereas in football is not necessarily as important. Perhaps he's looking to find more leaders in his team, perhaps looking to coax more out of them. If you look at the Iceland game back at the Euros, there weren't any leaders on the field at all. So perhaps he's looking to find more from the players he's got there now, or even more.
Southgate made a really interesting point about this the other day, where he said that from Steven Gerrard's international retirement in 2014, he thinks that lots of England's junior players hid behind Wayne Rooney.
Henderson said that as well, yeah.
And they allowed Rooney to take all the burden upon himself, and basically that gave the younger players an excuse to duck taking responsibility. Now, clearly, that is not a healthy situation, because you don't want all the burden of responsibility on one person. I think we did slightly see that at the Euros. And so if in this kind of post-Rooney environment, responsibility and leadership can be shared equally between, you know, Hart, Cahill, Dyer, Henderson, Kane, all the rest of them, then that's obviously going to be a more healthy thing for the team.
Here's one, actually. I think, hear me out on this, there's an argument that Beckham's goal against Greece in 2001 was actually one of the worst things to happen for the long-term future of the England team. A, because it created this kind of hero idea around the captaincy, and this kind of the obsession with it, or deepened it. And B, because it really made concrete the whole star complex in the England team that I think was damaging, for particularly through this Sven Goran Eriksson and quote-unquote golden generation.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely...
Before that, I mean, when Brian Robson was England captain, like, and it was a big thing. And all, so it's not that it started with Beckham,
but it
cemented it with Beckham. Yeah. I think it's fair to say. Sorry, Jack.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that if you look at the big issues really of the Sven era, which we've not really got past, are like the obsession, like one, the individualization, the obsession with individuals. And the two, you know, we were talking about this the other day, like the 2006 squad was probably like the best squad England have ever taken to a tournament in terms of like the aggregate level of the individuals, and yet they were rubbish. And they've not
very
really
dull team, yeah.
Yeah, and they've not really got past that. And it's only, you know, what, now coming up to 15 years since the Greece goal, that we can maybe work towards a position where we try and think about these things less individually, less as if we are dependent on some hero saving us.
But actually as well, that 2006 squad, I mean, you talk about the quality of the players, which is fine. The amount of leaders, the amount of guys in there who were kind of club captains or at least kind of important players within that team. If you think Gerrard, Lampard, Terry Beckham, like all of these guys who are Campbell, Ferdinand, all these guys who are big names in their club.
In midfield, actually, ended up being slightly self-defeating, because I think, as we were discussing off air, as Tony Evans said, it basically just meant that very few of the players, they weren't quite willing
very
to fully
selfish,
accommodate.
Yes. Yeah. They were selfish. They all wanted to play in their preferred position. But I think it's something to do with who in this, is something that we had a discussion that Ben and I had recently, is if you look at in this England squad, they're all goodish players, they're all okay players, but there's no real, there's no people really who are talismen for their side, except you could say the Tottenham guys.
Yeah.
And Harry Kane is a leading candidate, you'd say, to be. Miguel said this week that Harry Kane might be the best player in their position that England have had since Rooney at his peak, right?
Yeah, probably. I'd say, relative to his own position, I'd say Kane is by far the highest standard player in the team.
No one else either comes close.
Dele Alli could have a chance, but
Alli perhaps. It's a potential thing. I think you're looking at. If you look at Kane right now, I think it was Lopetegui yesterday saying he wishes Kane was playing for Spain. But if you look at the others, like Raheem Sterling was bought by a big team to be a big player, but he's not there yet. Mm. Dele Alli he's been bought to be that player, and he's on the way, but not there yet. Stones is similar, but he's stumbling somewhat. Kane is the only one who's a truly world-class player in his position.
Yeah. I feel like Kane could fit the hero model. However, I mean, you guys see a lot more of Spurs than I do. Is he a real leader? He doesn't seem like, to me, necessarily a guy who leads. He leads by performance, an example, rather than leading in the traditional sort of lionheart sense.
Yeah, I think given the conversation we're having, I think that's a healthy thing.
To his benefit, yeah.
He's he leads by example. And because, I mean, one thing, he's quite a nice guy, but, you know, he seems a very decent bloke. And he will always give you in a pitch then. He's ultra committed.
In fact, you had a sit down with him last year, didn't you, Jack?
Yeah, I remember speaking to him about this, and he was telling me how his hero is Tom Brady, the Patriots quarterback, because of the way that Brady's job is like, it's almost like the job that Kane's is becoming at Tottenham. Like, he's the guy who has to deliver even when the team are up against it. He's the one who has to keep finding solutions and take all the responsibility upon himself. And obviously, like, being a centre forward in soccer is not quite the same as being a quarterback in American football. But the fact that Kane is thinking about his job in those terms shows his willingness to burden that responsibility and to accept the pressure of being the guy who has to bail his team out over and over again.
That's interesting, because the quarterback is, relative to its sport, probably the most important position in any sport. There is no other position like the entire.
You can tactically arrange it.
Of course, it's unbelievably complex, the things that they have to do, and it all comes down to what the quarterback can do at the end of the day. I mean, we have seen, I suppose, in recent years, to get really off topic, some other teams win Super Bowls with middling quarterbacks but really good defenses. But the point is that if Kane is seeing himself in that vein, he's saying that basically the team can't do it without me, which you could argue that has been true of Spurs for the last couple of years, because if he hadn't been around, then maybe they would have been in trouble. But if England are to be successful, they are probably going to need someone like Harry Kane to be a world-class talent up front. And that, you know, going with our conversation about the captaincy, is far more important than having a guy who might be the Lionheart who beats his chest as they're coming out the tunnel. Like, I think the Joe Hart example is probably the one. Joe Hart basically embarrassed himself out of the England team a lot of the time doing this overhyping. How did he describe it? He described it himself, didn't he talk about it?
Yeah, I remember him admitting, this would have been roughly a year ago.
It was post-Euros, right?
Yeah, when soon after he'd gone to Torino and had that incredibly chastening summer. And he admitted to us in an England press conference that he had gone too far with the kind of overhyping and the sort of self-motivation. I actually think Joe Hart is a really instructive example to this discussion about, like, leadership and passion, because everything that Hart did at the Euros and how badly wrong it went shows up what I think a lot of people have always suspected, which is that, one, a lot of this, like, ostentatious pride and passion stuff is performative, and two, that it's counterproductive.
It felt like he had a vision in his head of what an England leader should be like, so I'm going to really max that up.
Yeah, and actually what Southgate made a point yesterday which is very much relevant to that, where he was responding to the criticism that England players didn't care enough. And he said it was, quote, outrageous that they would be accused of that. And he said that, in fact, from his own experiences, he often thought that England players cared too much. They were too wrapped up in it.
Yeah, we saw against Iceland, probably.
Yeah, to perform successfully. And he was talking about his own experiences. He wasn't talking about Hart at Euro 2016. But that criticism is absolutely applicable to what we saw from Hart and lots of other England players last year.
Perhaps with Joe Hart, though, you're saying it is interesting, it's performative, and it does feel a little bit put on, almost. And I have this theory, which again is moving slightly away from football, but in a different direction, is there are a lot of countries around the world, and I saw this a lot when I was in South America, and weirdly it was when someone was attempting a coup in Ecuador. And you see, and I was with some Colombians and Ecuadorians, and they were all crying and watching the CNN in Spanish, and they were kind of wondering, like, you know, they're very proud of their country, immense patriotism that you don't see in England. You know, they're basically, for one reason or another, probably because England is just so old. Other countries that have perhaps gained independence more recently or are in different political situations to us are far more patriotic and far more proud of their country than a lot of these English players. Not to say that these England players aren't proud to play for England. However, it's much more of an emotional explosion for someone playing, for example, for Kosovo, which is a newly independent nation, than it is for playing for England. I feel sometimes that there are players who try and put on how much of a huge emotional show it is. And even American sports, America is only 200 or 230, 240 years old, right? So they only gained independence in 1775.
1776.
Sorry, close enough. The weeping at the national anthem and all these things is an immense patriotism because of indoctrination in schools and all these things. But I think perhaps in England we just don't have that strength of attachment, and I'm sure there are lots of people that do, and I'm going to get plenty of abuse.
Well, mind
for
you,
saying
we say this after kind of nationalism essentially forced Brexit.
Of course, well, but
it's more. I know what you're saying. It's very more disparate in England.
That indeed has highlighted the divide, has it not? That you've got a country where there are people who feel very strongly that and there are a lot of. I mean, if you ever see England fans abroad, I know they've got a bad reputation, and with reason in some places, but they travel really well, and there's a lot of guys that love that England team, and there's nothing they like more than following England around the world, and they have a hell of a time doing it. But at the same time, there are a lot of people, and we'll get onto this later, who are disconnected with the England national team, and that's for a number of reasons, which we'll get onto later. But not to move away from the captaincy quite yet, because I think that is a key issue. Do you think, you mentioned the cricket thing and the rugby thing, Ben, and it's interesting because in rugby, only the captain can speak to the referee. So it is more than a ceremonial role. In cricket, you are a de facto coach. And these are obviously two very traditional English sports. Do you think Southgate moving away from that model, if he does, would damage his stock as England manager? And should it?
I mean, I think Southgate's going to live or die by his results, and hopefully, as an England fan, I'd hope that by unburdening someone of the captaincy or by helping others take that mantle alongside the captain, that would overall be positive for the team. Which obviously,
is there just no obvious candidate either?
I think that's also possible. You look like, like we said before, when you had a Rio or a Terry in the side, it's obvious who's going to be captain. And even though, say, Henderson's captain of a big club like Liverpool, he doesn't necessarily embody the characteristics of certain captains from years past. I think Kane would be, like we've said, closest to that. But perhaps it's Southgate looking to go in a slightly different route.
It does feel like he has been trying to take this team in a different direction. I was quite impressed with him. I covered the England-Scotland game in Glasgow with Miguel in June and spoke to Southgate after that game. I was quite impressed with him, having previously thought he was a bit of a dull appointment, appointment, a safe appointment, which he almost certainly was. But I was quite impressed with him because he does feel like a bit more of a modern manager.
Yeah,
I think we saw at Middlesbrough, that job probably came a bit too soon for him. And it didn't work out and they got relegated. But with England, I think he spent a lot of time travelling around and seeing how other coaching systems work rather than just teams and coaches, coaching systems in Spain and Germany. And I think because he's trying things differently, I think we could see a couple of these things and it might upset the traditionalists, but this could be a better way forward. Again, as Ben says, you've got to get past the last 16 in tournaments. That's the only way of doing it, right?
But it is one of the, and this probably feeds into the discussion we're going to have about kind of maybe the disconnected England team, but the fundamental problem with England for the last two decades, essentially, that bar 2008, they always qualify, and they always qualify usually fairly easy, as is the case now. So it just means that essentially everything is irrelevant and nothing means anything until they get to the first knockout game of a tournament. That's what it all comes down to.
And Jack, having seen Southgate on Sunday, what were your ultimate thoughts on him and the direction he's taking England in?
I really like Southgate. I didn't really know what to think when I first started covering him as England manager. But I think he's very smart. He really engages with the questions that he's asked. He has proper opinions, and when he answers questions, he doesn't just give stock answers. Like he thinks things through, and sometimes he'll actually say something like, "Well, don't think about it like this. Think about it like that," which is always the site. You know, there's not many managers in the Premier League who are that engaging. Like, I think there's, you know, Wenger's like that, sometimes Guardiola, depending on what mood he's in, sometimes Mourinho. So I actually find him sometimes quite persuasive, and even I think sometimes he gets it wrong. So for example, I think he got it wrong when he's this would have been last year when we were talking about Wilfried Zaha, and he said that players who have the option to play for England or another country should want to play for England. I think that was a misstep.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
But equally, I think that I like the fact that he's willing to have what might be unpopular opinions and try and explain them and argue for them. And I respect him for that.
Yeah, I don't think he's a tactical genius. I don't think necessarily, like, he might not be the best technical coach in the world. But from what I have seen of him so far, and I know being good with the media is not the be-all and end-all when it comes to a job like that, but he does seem to have enough know-how and enough knowledge to navigate this. It's interesting. We should have had Sam Allardyce in charge still, had it not been for his bizarre little dalliance with a pint of wine. But the direction that the team has taken is so different now. The paths are completely miles apart because Allardyce was all about pragmatism and short-termism. And I do almost think that he would have been like the ideal tournament man.
So does Ottawa, I think, yeah.
You know, it's impossible not to conclude that based on what we've seen from him before. But Southgate, I think, might be better for the FA and England long-term, which is how everyone's been begging the FA to think for a while.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Jack, the second big topic we want to get onto today, I feel like we've really covered the captaincy off, is a slightly difficult one, but it's something Gareth Southgate did touch on again when he was talking about the fans at Wembley selling tickets, etc., and backing the team. There does seem to be a bit of a disconnect between the public and the England team, or alternatively, you could say, just less of an interest in international football and the England team. I want to talk about why that is, but first start with what Southgate said, and we can move on to maybe exploring the reasons why we think this might be.
So at the press conference on Sunday, Southgate said that it wasn't helpful for England fans to boo and jeer the team. He stopped just short of criticising the fans, although you could tell that he was quite unimpressed with fans who boo and jeer, which was very clear, I think, from what Harry Kane said immediately after the game on Friday. So clearly there is a feeling within the England camp that the fans should get behind the team more. It's interesting, this, because I don't think that... I remember, you know, it was only, maybe 8 years ago that the Wembley fans were quite vicious towards players like Frank Lampard and Ashley Cole, who would often get booed playing for England. I don't think we have that anymore. I don't think there is as much negativity. What there is disconnect or just a kind of lack of interest, I think, which goes broader than simply the people who go to the games at Wembley.
Well, this is obviously a very basic thing, but I was even thinking about the weekend. We got Jordan Henderson in the mix on after Malta, and some of it was discussing the captaincy, of course. The game itself, which by then, these quotes came out last night, so that's 2 days after the Malta game and no one cares about the Malta game. And then a little bit on Liverpool and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. And obviously, you're going to lead in on the Liverpool stuff because it gets traction. I mean, you put up a kind of a... And again, this is a very slightly crude example, but you put up something on Twitter about a little bit of England news and there's not much take-up at all. But yeah, if it's club-related, then suddenly it explodes.
From a purely digital web point of view, the web traffic during international breaks, I can tell you, is much worse than during club time. People have much more interest in club football. It's obviously a much more global thing. The Premier League is itself a global brand now. So we get a lot of web traffic to our website, which had a record month last month, if you're asking. We actually had a load of traffic from Nigeria, from the US, from India. 71% of our traffic for that big boxing fight the other week was from the US. We've got, you know, worldwide audience. For England, obviously, that audience isn't as big. You're basically limiting to yourself to, I think, the population of England, excluding Scotland, Ireland, all the others, is about 40 or 50 million, isn't it?
But it is an odd thing. I mean, I remember, like, around, say, 98, when basically the Brazil national team was essentially the modern Barcelona, Real Madrid, and they were the most glamorous club in the world. And they got so much, I mean, you could see it with all, I suppose, all the marketing deals.
They're glamorized.
Yeah. And I think for a long time, maybe England were part of that, one of, kind of, you know, seven or eight nations who were kind of brands in their own right. But that just appears to be kind of completely dissipating now. Now, I think it will check, like, because tournaments are kind of events in and of themselves, obviously, but people are still usually interested in tournaments. But for the 2 years in between that, it's just, I mean, I think there are a few levels too. I mean, I was talking to one of the guys in the plane back from Malta, and we were kind of saying, like, you know, I suppose growing up when you had ambitions as a journalist, it was almost like the game itself, and you would consider covering your country or covering the international game as the pinnacle of your career. But even that it reflects the sport as well, in the sense that international football no longer is the pinnacle of football in any sense. And also,
would you not say covering the World Cup final is bigger than the Champions League final?
Yeah, but that's still only because probably the Champions League final is every year, whereas the World Cup is every 4 years.
Yes.
So the infrequency creates kind of a. It still kind of perpetuates that feeling of specialness about it, and to be fair again, that's a tournament issue. But international football in general, I suppose, from a very, very basic football point of view, because of the way the game has moved on, because of the sophistication of top club teams, because the integration, because they can, you know, accumulate the best players in the world, no international side can be anywhere near as good as a country, and you actually can see that in the quality of the games. It's just not as slick, not as good. But I think there are loads of other issues why international football is fading as well.
What I didn't want to do was just have four journalists discussing this. So I did actually see on Twitter there's a load of responses to a question about the disconnect, and I'm just going to read you a selection of them because there's a variety of different reasons, and I think it's important to get them all in. One person says too many qualifying games don't help the fans' mood, and tired of having Premier League games interrupted for them, which I think speaks to a greater problem when you contrast it with the Premier League.
Actually, just to that is relevant to the FA Cup as well, because one of the problems the FA Cup has had is suddenly you're so invested in the storylines of the Premier League, and then an FA Cup weekend. And it's just too much of a disruption to the general season, which I think why there could be an argument for kind of making internationals kind of over a shorter period of time in June or whatever. But sorry,
Southgate was an uninspiring appointment for already an uninspiring team. I think you could take that how you want. Too many boring qualifying games when we know England will be rubbish in the tournament. I've given up watching England team as the football is naff. That's something I'm sure we'll go into. The fans' thirst for the glamour of the Premier League and Champions League has devalued qualifiers, the same as the FA Cup, etc. They're only interested in the finals tournaments, which I think is pretty fair. Through no fault of the team, I believe fans are tired of qualifying matches to tournaments. Yep. I think this is happening equally at club sides, the disconnect between fans and players. That's an interesting point as well. No one's interested anymore. The players certainly aren't. That's the biggest thing for me. It's a sideshow for them. And I wonder if you talk to some players off the record, how true that would be. Playing two holding midfielders against Malta. Yeah, okay, I get that. No one enjoyed England-Malta. Lisa Wilmiguel. And one final one, just saying qualifying format should change. We should have real challenges to get to these tournaments instead of getting humiliated when we're there. I think there's a range of reasons. I'm sure we're going to touch on all of them in some form. The qualifying thing is most interesting, Ben. It's what we talked about earlier. Imagine if Manchester United had to play Rochdale, Bury, Tranmere Rovers every week, and then once every 3 months they got to play Arsenal, or even more infrequently than that. The qualifying thing, though, is inescapable. So how do you fix international football from that point of view?
I don't think international football needs fixing, as it were. I think you look at the World Cup is still a peak for all fans. It's this wonderful thing every 4 years. It's a fact, from an England point of view, is they only seem to have a meaningful game every 2 years. So it's a last 16 or whatever. You look at there's still a place for international football and people still get excited about it. You look at Spain versus Italy on Saturday, it was a great game with some great players playing great football. It's the fact that England aren't testing themselves at that level, and then when they do, they get found out because they're doing it so infrequently.
But we talked about, especially, it really became obvious after the Euros and during the Euros, the quality of coaching in international football just isn't as good. And what you see, therefore, is people talking about Gareth Southgate playing two holding midfielders against Malta. Well, I mean, his job is to get the result there. It's not to score 10. They got the result as they needed. We saw Antonio Conte at the last Euros, and he was by far the best coach, and Italy overachieved with the squad that we discussed the other day. It's so weak. Do you think international football, though, you can't really recover the quality of it with the money that's in the club game?
That's it. Well, this is the fundamental problem. It's the cup game, and particularly the big clubs, Champions League and Premier League, given the broadcasting deals and all, it's just so all-consuming now. And I think we are in an era, I mean, I think you can see it with support, it's an era of ultra-investment. And it's an interesting discussion as well. But it seems a kind of national, or feelings of patriotism, national pride can't actually pierce that for a lot of kind of maybe a younger generation of fans.
The fact that you have countries like Abu Dhabi and Qatar buying up club teams, pouring all their money into them, which has a distorting effect on the transfer market for clubs, only goes to show that the kind of flow of money, and from that quality and attention into club games, has just completely swamped the international games. And how can international football ever compete with
that? And actually, in relation to the Brazil point, the Brazil brand, remember, it was about a decade ago when a lot of the kind of Qatari league that would specifically almost buy in Brazilian players. Because of the cachet attached to Brazil. And now they obviously realise that, well, that's not really going to help the Qatari league because no one cares still.
It does make you wonder, though, if a country like Qatar, I know it's not the most populous country on earth or whatever, but if they had invested even 10% of what they've spent on their links with clubs around the world, particularly Paris Saint-Germain and Barcelona, if they'd invested that money into the football infrastructure of Qatar itself, I'm not saying you're going to get immediate results, but the kids that could come out of that.
Well, they have been investing quite a lot, and what they have, and they've also been looking very hard for players from other countries who can be nationalised. And
they've done that in athletics as well. Is it?
Yeah, you definitely see
that the Bahrainian guys from Denmark and things like that.
So there is investment there in their team for the 2022 World Cup. But ultimately, I just think like no tinkering with the formats or the structures of international football can make up for the fact that club football's just wiped them away, basically, with all this money.
Yeah.
So with regards to England, the disconnect with England, how much of this can we say is partially down to the international football just not being as good as it used to be? The quality is now not what it was, and club football has easily surpassed it. Is that fair to say?
That's fair.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But also there are other issues at hand here that are specifically England, do we think?
Yeah, I
probably
think so.
Yeah.
So I'd look at two. I think this is definitely the case. Like, if you remember the kind of national mania when England were in big tournaments from Euro 96 through to, say, World Cup 2006, I don't think we'll ever see that again. Like, and I don't think that's just to do with how good the England team is.
I would dispute that. I think if they got, say, 2018, they got to the second round, got a good win, and then suddenly in a massive quarter final, I think you would see mania around that game.
I just don't think it would be as big going into the tournament.
That's true.
And like, it was just so. Anyone who was in England, particularly in 04, 06, even Euro 2000 when England were terrible, it was just such a kind of dominant thing in national life. You know, front page of the papers every day, that kind of thing. And I don't think we'll see that repeated. I think for two reasons. One is the Premier League point. Like, I think most football fans now identify so much as like with their Premier League team rather, and that has to come at the cost of supporting England. I also just don't think we have the same kind of mass culture that we did in the same way. Like, England, you know, British culture has changed mainly through technology over the last 10 or so years. And that means that people don't rally. I mean, you almost see this a bit in the coverage of the death of Diana 20 years ago, which has been remembered this week. Like, we don't, as a nation, we can't kind of rally behind these big events in the same way as we used to.
Well, that's almost more of a media point, I suppose. And up until 2006, before kind of, you know, social media exploded, that basically the national discussion and discourse was dictated by what was on the front page of the papers, what was on terrestrial television. Now everything is so much more disparate and diverse, and people kind of, and as we see, as we just discussed with how England don't do that well in terms of web hits, people will just gravitate to what they're interested in,
rather than
being kind of, okay, we're going to be discussing this now.
That is an interesting split between what you'll see on the back pages of newspapers, which are obviously more traditional, and the average age, obviously, of a newspaper reader is far higher than it is on our website, for example. So, you know, on the back page of newspapers, it'll all be England, England, England. But the fact is that that's not being reflected in what people are reading on the website. And in an age where I think people are now a bit more open-minded to, okay, well, if the readers don't want to read this stuff, then why are we investing such resources in covering it? Now, you can't always be a slave to this, because otherwise you'd just be going to the lowest common denominator on things. But I think it has perhaps realigned expectations, Ben, is that fair to say, about these events and how they're covered?
I think so, yeah. I mean, you look at a World Cup or a Euros, and it's the things that people, certainly online, want to read about is the next player Man United could sign out of one of these teams.
Everything's club-related.
And that has definitely changed in the last 10 years or so since 2006. I do think if England had a team actually that could challenge, that it would be, you'd see a wave of support behind them. You look at what happened to Portugal last summer, and they had no chance until they got all the way, and it was a remarkable thing, and the whole country got behind. So
they are a nation of bandwagon jumpers.
Yeah, for sure. So
I think most nations are, because it's a discussion that's often had in Ireland as well.
Right, and it's fair. I think the club country point is interesting. From a completely personal point of view, the moment I realised that I didn't care about England as much as the club I support was when they were losing against Germany in the 2010 World Cup. And I was with my mate, Steve, who goes to England away, and he was distraught because we were getting battered by Germany. Mm. And it was the same summer that my club had nearly gone out of business and been saved at the last minute from administration. And it just made me realise, it was like, this wouldn't affect me that much. Going out of the World Cup to England it didn't feel like the end of anything. Like, I didn't really care. Whereas when Palace were on the brink of going out of business, I was incredibly affected by it and doing everything I could to try and help in it. And it's that summer I kind of realised. And obviously I still support England more than any other team, but for me, I'm just not as interested in it, almost in international football. And I think around the tournaments it is different. I loved covering the World Cup in Brazil and the Euros last summer. And the World Cup next summer, I'm sure, is going to be great. But it's more for the big coming together of all these huge football stars and what it is and what it has been.
A festival football.
What it has been historically. Mm. And my big fear about Russia is that it won't be a festival in the same way. The
country's too big, almost.
I think the country's too big. I think there might not be the travelling fans in the way that even Brazil, where people weren't expecting a lot of travelling fans. 100,000 Colombians in Belo Horizonte for that first game, all the Chileans, the Argentinians.
Also in terms of Brazil, I can think of something like 6-7 tournaments now, and I can't think of a more ideal setting for, again, a quote-unquote festival of football at the World Cup is than Copacabana Beach. It was just, it was incredible.
Just to really go off the topic of people pulling away from England and the national team, is there a danger that with international football kind of alienating people a little bit through no fault of its own, through the strength of the club game, having a World Cup in Russia, then a Euros which is spread around a continent with no real centre to create that festival, then a World Cup in Qatar, are we in danger of just killing off international football as a spectacle for fans, do we think?
It's an interesting one, that in terms of just at a very crucial period for international football, it's as if they've picked a series of wrong venues.
Exactly. I mean, it just seems like a very dangerous time for them to be doing. I mean, we all know how Russia and Qatar ended up doing what they're doing, but how on earth do they try and carry these World Cups off as something important and something that people are going to be invested in?
It's a missed opportunity, isn't it? Because this is, you know, this is the point in football's development when I think people most need the purity, if that's the right word, of international football as a kind of counterpoint to club football, which is just so dominated by the kind of global elite and the mega rich. And so for international football to be selling itself down the water and destroying everything that made it so special is just, I mean, it's really, really very bad timing.
It was actually something I was thinking of on Saturday, just obviously 2 days after transfer window and after England's match. I think Southgate has a bit of an issue to solve with his midfield. And whereas in the club game, obviously, all of Southgate's counterparts at the top of the Premier League would basically, or what they tried to do all summer, we have a problem, let's sign a player for that problem. And one of the remaining glories of international football is that you can't do that. And no matter how good any international football team is through history, they've always had one problem that the manager has to solve. But it's a pity then that all the best football minds aren't there solving those problems. They're in the club game.
Well, I mean, he could have gone and bought Danny Drinkwater for £35 million. That would be the obvious answer if you're Southgate. But you look at, the interesting thing for me is the transfer thing, like you said. When I was covering Spain, they just brought in Diego Costa from Brazil.
Yeah.
You know, so as close as you're going to get to an international transfer. And it did seem to solve their never-ending problem that they didn't have a number nine. And it ties in with what you were saying earlier on about Lopetegui, Ben, saying that he wants Harry Kane because that's the position that Spain have really been lacking in.
I think it speaks wider to the wider problem of, for want of a better word, the death of coaching, almost. It's that if you look at, I mean, Harry Redknapp in the Championship is famous for it. He's gone in this summer to go in, or end of last season, and this summer he's, oh, I need more players in. And instead of looking at the players you've got and trying to improve them, too many coaches have turned to the checkbook to go and fix it.
There's a piece that might be on The Independent in the next 48 hours on that very issue. That's half written.
It's like Conte is, for me anyway, the best manager in the league, and that's why Chelsea won the league. He didn't get the players he wanted last summer. I think that's most people would agree on that. He got the tools he was given on the 1st of September last year, and then thought, how am I going to do something with these?
But yeah,
it is easy to be dismissive of guys like Guardiola and Mourinho as checkbook managers because they have spent the most money over the last 5 years by distance. But at the same time, we've seen Mourinho do this before. Mourinho in international football will be fascinating. Because, I mean,
I'd say to win a tournament.
Yeah, you've got to fancy him to win a tournament. But equally, we know that Guardiola had an interest in that Brazil job when it was open. Imagine Guardiola in international football, but with the reduced coaching time. Would Guardiola be able to get his messages across? Because what his is, Jack, it's a very deeply coached thing.
Yeah, I think what we saw in Guardiola's first season at City is that his football is so complex and it requires, there's like a theoretical element to it first, that you have to understand the Guardiola principles before you can even start to think about where you have to stand on the pitch or what you're meant to do when you're 1-0 up or anything like that. And therefore, you know, as much I would certainly have some scepticism about Guardiola's ability to deliver in that kind of environment. And also because, I mean, this is another issue that you might have with Guardiola, is that he does seem to be a guy who, because of the complexity of his football, is at his best when he has brilliant players in every position. Unfortunately, that has been the case in some of the jobs he's had so far. But if he were to be manager of, say, Spain, or even anyone else, like as Miguel was saying, the reality is you're not going to have world-class players in every position. And therefore, he's gonna, you know, there's gonna be a bit of an issue there.
On a massive but slightly connected tangent, actually, just in relation to Costa, I think there's an argument David Villa was actually Spain's most important player throughout that, rather than Xavi.
And that's why they brought him back in the squad.
And I mean, imagine Guardiola, how grumpy he's going to be at 60, but he could be Spain manager. And that also speaks.
Well, actually, probably wouldn't, would he? Unless by then there's a Catalan
national team by that point. Yeah. The issue with we're saying about the poor quality of coaching, I think you did a numbers breakdown on this, Miguel. You won't be able to remember the numbers because it's over a year ago now. But a lot of the coaches there were either young, unproven guys, basically former players who've been given the job with nothing, like Mark Wilmots, who turned out to be probably the worst coach at the tournament.
Yeah.
Or the old guys who have been and done it and have been around the block and kind of gradually working their way down the pecking order. It's a bit of a talent donut scenario. If you're in your peak coaching years and you're at the Euros, you're probably not very good.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
I suppose Conte did it for reasons of national pride and also because maybe how specific his situation was. I mean, he just kind of, well,
walked out on Juve
for similar issues that are going on in Chelsea now. But he ultimately, he wanted to get out of it as quick as possible because he found he missed the day-to-day. He missed the challenge.
So the other thing this is moving away from England slightly, isn't it? But I was reading Gary Neville earlier on said that, you know, the disconnect with international football isn't necessarily a modern phenomenon. They were booed against Saudi Arabia at Wembley before Euro 96. If you think before Italia 90, when the nation kind of fell back in love with England, supporting England and England football team wasn't a very popular thing because of fan troubles abroad and the 80s and stuff. So after having discussed it for so long, Ben, are we reading too much into this disconnection? Or do you think there is genuinely something perhaps that the FA could do to try and engage people, re-engage people with this English team? Or are we just a country where only success will do it?
I think as so often it's probably a grey area. I think if you play winning football, people will watch it. And I think people will be interested in a winning football team. I do think that we have got to a stage where club football is this behemoth which international can't compete with.
It's too good.
It's too good. The standard is too good. You get the Champions League every fortnight, you're going to have a better game, 2, 3, 4 better games in the Champions League than any of the games we've seen over the international break. But there's nothing international football can do about that. Whether it's a changing qualification format, so there's more good teams in the same groups as each other, that kind of thing. But I think as far as England goes, I think if they continue to push what they're trying to push, so try and push talented players through.
The more modern Southgate approach.
And if that plays winning football, and like we said, if it somehow stumble through into a quarter final, I think you'd see enough people still come back to them.
I think Neville was wrong, though, and I think he's kind of confused in two different situations, two superficially similar situations, but actually different situations.
Because there was
two friendlies, and let's remember they're friendlies where they're booed off and people were half interested. It's still kind of 40,000 people going to a game, and it was still, as Jack said, in the peak of this genuine mania before a tournament. So I think I don't think they're comparable. I think what's going on now is different to then, and we literally have the numbers to prove it.
Yeah, Delaney slams Neville. I think there was an interesting piece in the Times today by James Gearbrand about how friendlies are not only pointless, they are genuinely skewing, they're worse than that. They take off your points in the world rankings. If England are to be successful at tournaments, they need to be top seeds, because otherwise you get stuck with Brazil, Argentina, Germany, and we know how that ends. Is there not perhaps a point that England just need to be savvier from top to bottom? Because it does. I think someone raised this with a senior member of the FA that there was less interest in the England team, and they kind of batted it off as if it just isn't true. We have the numbers, as you say, to show that it isn't true. So do you think that maybe the FA are in a little bit of denial, Jack, about the interest in the England team?
I don't know. I'd be reluctant to endorse like an approach whereby England played fewer games against good teams, particularly given that we were just talking about how one of the downsides of the international calendar is that England had these endless games against Slovakia and Slovenia.
Yeah.
And then every
second international, I guess.
Yeah,
Slovakia
never play anyone good. And I think that one thing the FA's done well is getting these kind of glamorous friendlies. Again, we've played recently against France, Brazil, Germany, Italy, Spain. Even if that is damaging to the ranking points, like I don't think that we should see the national team as like a headlong pursuit of ranking points.
Also, this is England. Like this shouldn't be. This is a country of sufficient size that it shouldn't be kind of trying to game the system.
Size wise, England not that big, but as a football nation in terms of the money and infrastructure, that is where England are underachieving.
Yeah, completely. But they have enough there that they shouldn't have to game the system. They shouldn't have the structures in place in their own right that produces a high-quality team. Because, coming from a small nation, you can look at what's possible for England enviously.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think we have gone way off topic, but also gone straight back on topic and managed to cover off most of that. I am pretty happy with it all, but I do want to set you one thing, Miguel. There's no point talking about England versus Slovakia, because by the time people listen to this, it will be over. So I'm just going to set you one teaser quickly. Harry Kane, Eric Dier and Dele Alli playing at their club home ground tonight, Wembley. If any of them score, they would become the first England player to score at their club's home ground since who?
It must be some of the United players at Old Trafford. Beckham.
The answer is not David Beckham. If you do know the answer, then please tweet us at Indie Football, and the winner will get a programme and a team sheet from Wembley tonight, because I said so. Thank you for everyone. That is all that we have time for. Next time you have me invading your ear space, we will have a full Premier League weekend behind us. England will be one step closer to Russia, we expect, and we may have our first top flight managerial casualty of the season. So until then, my thanks to Ben Burrows.
Thank you.
Miguel Delaney.
Thank you.
And Jack Bitbrook.
Thank you.
And also to producer Tom and our friends at Acast, the podcast providers. I've been Ed Malley, and this has been the Indie Football Podcast. Thank you and goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.